Hey folks, I'm Robert. I'm an alcoholic. I drank and drug for 34 years. Left to my default, I'm the biggest piece of shit sinner of the universe. The dichotomy of all that. Left to my default, I beat the shit out of myself with a stick every day. And then when I get tired of that, I turn and I start beating you up with it. Because after a while, I get tired of making myself feel small. So in my default, I want to make you feel small so I can feel better about me. Weird. Weird to say on Father's Day, I lost my father when I was 2. So I grew up with just a mom who supplied us with all the externals, but no nurturing. I didn't even know that until I got into recovery and realized that. She gave us all the externals of a middle-class life, but was never there. So I grew up, as soon as I started getting a consciousness, I grew up over in Shreveport, which was a big mistake. I realized early on, it was like, there's got to be some mistake here. I'm not supposed to be here in this shitty town. But I was I craved attention, and I would do anything for attention. It didn't matter what kind it was. It could be great attention. It could be I got in trouble yet again. Cops were always coming to the house and having a nice, quiet discussion with Mom and saying, he's soon going to juvenile court, Miss Saxon. So I skated by. I never really got in serious trouble. But I was always acting out in school, in private time, with friends. I was always the ringleader. Let's go do this. I'd hatch these wild plans. Started drinking when I was about 14 years old. And, you know, they say that you stop maturing when you start drinking. So that's okay in your teens. And it's still okay in your 20s. It's not looking so great in your 30s. And when you get to be in your 40s and you're still acting like a whiny, titty-baby teenager, that's really unattractive. And that's where I was by the time I quit. I grew up thinking it was the externals that you were looking for to make you happy. I grew up in the Methodist Church, of course, believing I was taught this, that the spiritual being is an external from me. And I've learned differently since. I only used, as I got to be an adult, I couldn't wait to get away from Shreveport. The day after graduation from high school, I was gone. And moved away and then started a series of geographics. I didn't even know that's what it was called. I moved every 2 years. When the shame of what I had done and what you knew about me, after about 2 years, and I couldn't face you anymore, I just pick up and move to another city. I didn't find another city where nobody knew me, enroll in a new college, trailing college credits. I didn't give a shit. Just as long as the stuff would fit in my car, I was gone. And that was a lot of stuff, a lot of geographics. I continued to drink, and I was garbage mouth. You said, here, take this. I said, sure. Afterwards, I'd say, what was that again that I just took? Moved around a lot, as I said, and constantly in search of being of something. I didn't even know what. Over the years, my library—I had all these self-help books on my library in my library. All these self-help books that I'd written, I'd read, and occasionally I'd go to therapy, and I would tell her these story. I would tell them these stories, and they'd say, "Well, how much alcohol was involved during that fistfight on the streets of London?" And I'd say, "No more than usual." I lied to therapists. Of course, who doesn't? A good alcoholic never tells the truth, right? A good active alcoholic never tells the truth. By about my early, my late 20s, I was living out in New Mexico. That's where my higher power took me, out to New Mexico. And I had gotten, my partner and I at the time had gotten this house that had the driveway with the dogs that ran with a car up to the house and the incredible view and all of that. So I had all these externals, and I was fucking miserable. I was just, I couldn't drink enough. I couldn't put enough substances in my body. And let me tell you know, when you're out in the middle of nowhere and you're high as a kite at 4 o'clock in the morning, it's a real drag because there's nothing to do. You know, you can't go to another bar because there aren't any. So I think my higher power had me move out there to hear the still small voice in me, because I'd lived in New York for many years, and it's really hard to hear your still small voice in New York. It's a pretty loud city, you know. Moved out to New Mexico, where it's super quiet, and I was sitting out on the deck one day, and I heard, "This isn't it. This isn't it." As I sat there with my glass of vodka and rocks on my head, "This isn't it." So I began this process, started a midlife crisis at 37. I began to shed all that, and I went back to New York. Continued to drink. By then I was 40, and I was, yee-haw, I'm single, I'm back in New York. Man, my drinking really took off then. I would drink every night. I kept all the externals, as you can imagine, I kept all the externals looking good. Had a job, had an apartment, went to the gym every day. And got through the gym really quick, and then ran to the bar to power drink. We'd slam back martinis, and then around 9:30 go have something to eat to get some ballast, and then go have a couple of nightcaps. And then I was home by 9:30, because by that point I was beginning to slur my words. At 9:30 at night, I was falling. I didn't want you to see that shit. So I'd go home, but I didn't stop drinking. I'd go home and keep drinking by myself, do that drink and dial thing. And where I've left messages for people, and I don't know who I talked to or who I pissed off. I never used the word hangover. It was a really ugly word, so I was just fuzzy every morning. My eyes were bloodshot. I reeked of vodka every day, despite the fact I had a shower every morning. People would say, "Dude, you stink. When was the last time you had a shower?" And I was like, "This morning." You know, I couldn't even smell it. I couldn't look at you. There was such shame. I couldn't look at you until after lunch. I would start sobering up and feeling less fuzzy after lunch. Toward the end of my drinking, before I got sober, I'd had these relationships, and it was the same one over and over and over again. I took hostages. I would start to woo with all kinds of stuff, and dinners and trips and stuff, and the red flags are just flying past. Didn't care, because I'm getting attention. I'm getting attention. The person isn't right for me, but I don't care, because I'm getting attention. So then I'm in this relationship, and about 9 months into it, I start to wake up and think, I don't even like this person. How did I get here? Then it would take me a whole another year to extract myself. So I went through these series of, like, two-year relationships. I had some longer ones, but take these poor people hostage. And, of course, when I was drinking, I thought, well, it's all their fault. Why do I keep meeting the same person over and over and over again? It's just a different person with the same person with a different head on their shoulders. Then I got in this program and realized, oh, it wasn't them. So I had gone to therapy a lot and lied. I had begun to, after I was there for 9/11 and got to watch was a witness to the towers falling. And about 3 months later, I found this church, this New Age church, with the most amazing speaker. Her name, she's an ordained New Age Jewish Italian New Age minister. Her name was August Gold, one of the most powerful public speakers I've ever heard in my life. And I went and I listened, and at the end of the service, I went up to her and I said, "Would you just come home and read me the phone book?" And she said, "Honey, whatever it takes." So I started going to this church, and I'm still drinking. Then I get involved in service in this church, and I'd stand up in front of about 300 people every Sunday to give the announcements. And I'd be hungover. And I'm supposed to be being present, and I'm hungover. I'm altered. Well, after about 2 years of that, I resigned, because it was like, I'm not being fed the spiritual. I'm supposed to be getting something from this. And I just feel like I'm giving. I'm not getting anything. So I left the church, and I'm still searching. And I had done, years before, I had done the artist's way. if any of y'all have ever heard of The Artist's Way, and part of it is journaling every morning, like 3 pages. Doesn't matter if you just vomit onto the page. It doesn't matter. Just get 3 pages written. And that had somehow stuck over the years, and every single morning, hungover with a cup of coffee, I'd be writing just this ridiculous stuff. I went back and read one after I got sober, and I thought, who wrote this crap? Poor guy. And one morning it popped out on the page, I'm an alcoholic. That was really tough to read because I'd never been honest with myself. Others probably knew it, but that was the first time I actually saw it in black and white. So I called a friend of mine who called a friend, and they took me to my first meeting that night down in the West Village, and it was a beginner's meeting. I honestly thought that everyone was a beginner there. And I cried, just ugly cried, and talked and shared. And I went home after that meeting. You know, people gave me their phone numbers. It was like, what are you giving me your phone number for? I don't want this. And they invited me to go out afterwards. No, I don't want to go have shitty coffee with you after this. And I went home because I love isolating. No, I don't really want to be with these people. So I went home to and I'm standing there heating up some leftovers of some food I cooked the night before and passed out before I ever ate. And I thought, I could have a drink. No one will know. I could have one. And I thought, well, really? Two will know. I'll know. And actually, God will know. That's too many. You see, I had accepted that there is a God sometime before, but I only used God when I was, I needed to pray the foxhole prayers. God, help me come down off this drug. I've got to go to work in 3 hours. God, help me drive home. I'm only going to drive 5 miles an hour because I'm so high I'm going to hit the curb and park cars. Help me drive home five miles, and it would take me like an hour. God, help me to get home before any cops find me. Help me to find my keys. You know, all that shit, all those foxhole prayers that myself and other people have used. And so I didn't really have any use for a higher power other than that. So I that night I did not have a drink after that first meeting. And I went back the next night to another meeting. And I went back the next night after that. And I continued to go to meetings and listen. I sat in the back. No, I wasn't happy being here. I did not come in here with a smile on my face. None of us do. Who's happy to invite themselves to come to this? To admit defeat? I wasn't. Oh, gee, I'm Robert. I'm happy to be in Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. No. Sat in the back. I didn't want to talk to you. I didn't want to say, I'm Robert. I'm an alcoholic. Eventually, I got to say, I'm Robert. I'm recovering. But it took a long time for me to say, I'm Robert. I'm an alcoholic. It took me 6 months. I don't suggest my path to anybody. It took me 6 months to find a sponsor. I heard, work the 12 steps. So I went and got the 12 and 12 and I read it and I thought, okay, I'm done. I've done them. The person who had taken me to my first meeting called and said, let's have lunch. I said, okay. He said, how you doing on a sponsor? I said, I can't quite find the right person. There's always something off about, I'll hear somebody talk and I'll think, oh, maybe, man. They left the room and too fast. And he said, well, I'll be your sponsor, a temporary sponsor, if you want until you find one. And I said, okay, great. And he was my temporary sponsor for 7 years because New Yorkers don't like to make a commitment to anything. And he said, so how are you doing on the steps? And I said, great. Got the 12 and 12. I read it. I'm good. He said, we might want to work them a different way. For once, I didn't argue because, of course, all my life, I knew best for me. And I would discount whatever you said to me as what you thought I should do. So we began to work the steps. And he had me read the same step every day for 30 days before he was willing to sit down and talk to me about it. And I learned from doing it that way. Everybody has a different way of doing it. And this is the way I learned. To read the same step every day means about the 17th or 18th day, I'm seeing things that 18th read that I didn't get on the first two or three times. It took repetitive reading for me to get certain concepts in each of the steps. It was like, holy shit, I didn't see that before. And now I know why that we have a lot of repetitive reading in the program, because we're stubborn jerks. We don't want to listen. And we edit what we remember. So we need a lot of repetition to learn this stuff and to learn a way of living that helps us move through life more gracefully and in more acceptance and right-sized, at least for me. So I was going to these meetings, and I started to go to the Greenwich Village group on a regular basis, and somebody said after the meeting, after one of the meetings, they said, Robert, do you have a home group? And I said, no. And they said, "What, you could make this your home group. We like having you here." That was the first time someone had ever said, hey, come back. Most people were saying, don't come back. Don't ever come back. You're 86 from this bar. You're 86 from this club. Don't come back. And this person said, we like you here. Come back. Wow. So I did. And I started doing service. My sponsor said, in New York, it's a bit different. They have elections for positions every 3 months, hospitality and treasury and all the different service positions. And so every 3 months, for twice or two rounds, he'd say, elections are coming up. What are you going to go for? And I'd say, I'm really busy. And he'd say, okay. He was a really kind and gentle sponsor. So about the third time he asked, I said, oh, okay, I'll do something. And so I started doing hospitality. So I'd have to go an hour and a half early, and I'd have to do the shopping. I'd have to go to this church and set up everything in the basement, because you had to get those old coffee urns going an hour in advance. Because let me tell you, those alcoholics who get there, as you know, if the coffee's not ready, you got a bunch of pissed off drunks on your hand. So the coffee has to be ready. And so I'd sit behind that table with my arms folded. People come up and they get food and whatever, and they'd introduce themselves. I said, hi, nice to meet you. But, you know, it got me closer to people than I really had ever been sober before, because I never really went anywhere sober before. If a restaurant didn't have a full bar, I didn't go. If it had a wine and beer license, I didn't go. The day that New York got rid of its blue laws and you could buy liquor on Sundays, I felt like it was a fucking national holiday. Other people didn't understand why I was so... because the management, toward the end, the management of my daily drinking was, it was constant. I traveled a lot for work, so if I was going to come home on a Sunday, I needed to make sure there was vodka in the freezer before I left. Or if I didn't get to do that, then I needed to squirrel away those little airline bottles to bring home with me to get me through Sunday night until Monday, when I could buy more liquor. I rotated my liquor stores because I was too embarrassed to go so frequently. Like they cared. Like they cared. I'd rotate those liquor stores. So I'm getting sober, and I'm working the steps, and I took myself, I don't suggest this either, the 3 months into sobriety, I went on a holiday to Mexico, and to Puerto Vallarta at Christmas. I don't recommend traveling alone when you're newly sober, but I had the wherewithal to look up expat meetings before I went. And I went the very first night, and a gentleman there, the very first night I was there, he's from Chicago, and he said, hi, Robert, how are you? How's your spiritual condition? How is your spiritual condition? And I said, it's fine, but... And he'd let me vomit for a while, and he'd say, the answer's in the big book. And so every night he'd say, I go to this meeting, and every night he'd say, hello, Robert, how's your spiritual condition? I'd say, it's fine, but... And then we'd, you know, he'd say, the answer's in the big book. I'll never forget that guy. I was sort of planted a seed in my brain. And so I continued in this program, and I haven't had a drink... Having a relapse is a yet for me. I'll be 14 years sober this coming October. I had a great deal of resentment against all of mankind and the earth and people and family and all that when I came in the program. And, you know, I got to step 4, And it was really horrible to see in black and white the kind of person that I was. Because, by, you know, drinking constantly and doing drugs really warps your sense of who you are, or did for me at least. And so when I got to see in black and white the kind of person I really was, the disconnect between what was up here and what was I seeing on paper was just like, I can't handle that. So I stopped. I called my sponsor. I said, I'm the worst person to walk the face of the earth. I'm going to go jump off the George Washington Bridge. And he said, okay, stop. Go do something nice. Come back to it later. It took me like 6 months to come back to finish step four. I heard somebody one night, because it was just too much for me. I couldn't, you know, nobody says on a Tuesday night, yeah, I'm going to go home and rummage around in my shit. I can't wait to go home after work and finish step four. Nobody says that. Then I heard one guy one night say he had done an entire step four on just one family member. And it hadn't occurred to me, break it down into little bitty pieces of elephant. Don't try to eat that damn elephant all at once. I can't eat it all at once. So I went, and I thought, maybe that's the way, you know, go through a back door. So I did that. I went home and did it on a family member. Then I did it on the other family member, and it gave me the momentum to get through step four. And it gave me the momentum to move through, and I finally finished the steps on my second anniversary. I've done a lot of service in AA in New York and some here. So I was there for seven, 8 years of my sobriety. And the third year, I lost all the externals. My higher power decided, okay, we're going to take away everything that you think is important. And see how you do. Rely even heavier on AA. So I lost my business. This is when the recession happened. I lost my business. I lost my credit. Lost my my apartment. I lost everything. All the externals. And I'm packing up to leave this apartment. It's about a week before I had to get out. And I was like, I have no idea where I'm going. But I'm packing. A friend of mine called and said, "What do you? You know, we hadn't spoken in a while. What's going on?" And I told her. And she said, Go live at my apartment. I'm out in Long Island all the time. Go live in my apartment, you know. So, okay, so I'm going and I'm finding myself living on the 37th floor of this tricked out apartment building overlooking Central Park. And I'm broke. I have no job, no money. And I'm thinking, this is insane. Where I'm sitting now, I have a roof over my head. And I thought... at one point, I was sitting out on the balcony, and because you know, I thought those externals defined me so much, and now they were gone. So I thought all I need to do is take a step up onto this table and over the balcony, and all this can be over. This was a sober thought, I had when I was sober. I could just end it. Now, this was in the winter, and in the winter, when it snows and all the trash piles up and the snow falls on it, they suspend garbage pickup because they can't get to the trash. And so when people try to commit suicide during the winter, they're never successful because they fall on the trash. They maim themselves, possibly, but they don't die. And so I looked over the balcony, and I saw this massive levee of snow, which was covering all the trash, and I thought, it's going to be my luck. I'm just going to break my back and be a paraplegic for the rest of my life. I think I better get my fucking ass to a meeting is what I think I need to do and stop this self-indulgent crap. So I went to a meeting. Then I started painting apartments because that's all I knew. That's the only job I could get, was painting apartments. And after some time, my friend said, you need to go. So some other friends said, go down to Asbury Park and live in our house we have down there. We're only there on the weekends. So I did that. Friend said, I have a restaurant here if you need a job. So I took the job. And I thought, this will be the first time that I have waited tables sober. Let's see what it's like. Because I had waited tables through college, but never sober. So I did that. And when I left there, they said, you could always come back. I had never been told I could come back to a job because when I had been let go, it was like, you know, get out and never come back. I've had this wild ride through sobriety. I want life to be linear and smooth. And unfortunately, it's not. You know, my sobriety is looped back on itself and, you know, reversed and come back. And that's just life. It's messy, man. It's messy. So I'm in Austin now because the last gig I had in New York was coming to an end in my apartment. So I climbed back to, I had a job and I had an apartment in New York and back in New York. And the gig I had was coming to an end and my apartment lease was ending. I was telling my sister, I don't know what I'm going to do. Do I keep doing the same stuff over and over? It's just the same job at different companies. She said, why don't you move to Austin, get your real estate license and work for me and help me take care of Mom. So I prayed about it because I had begun to allow a higher power into my life more and more. I still wasn't turning everything over because I knew what was best in the money department and the job department and the relationship department. And God, you can take care of everything else. I'm not quite sure what else is left, but that was how I defined that. And so after 2 weeks, I said, okay, I'll go. So I ripped myself out of New York and drove a U-Haul with a trailer, having never done that, all the way down to Austin. And I was in shock the first 3 months I was here. And over the last 5 years, I have lived in Round Rock, where one adult brothers and sisters should never live together. Let me just put it that way. And so I did help with our mom, and she was over in Shreveport, and a lot's happened. You know, if you're taking care of an elderly parent, no one said it was. At first, I was angry about it. And then I had to sit and get right-sized about it. Nobody said it was going to be fun taking care of an elderly parent, nor did they say it was going to get better. And so it isn't, and it hasn't. She's getting older. She's got other crap going on. I've done my amends to my mom. Boy, there was a lot of anger there because she wasn't a perfect mom, you know? She didn't read that book on how to be a perfect mom. Then I realized when I got in this program, we got a better perspective. She learned that from her caregivers. That's all she learned. She didn't know any better. She did the best she could. So I've managed to forgive her for just being who she is. I've had to change to have that relationship change because you're not going to get an elderly parent to change. I'm just telling you that right now. Much easier for me to change than to get an 87-year-old Southern woman to change. Not going to happen. So she's now moved over here, and there's been a lot of stuff going on, and I'd love to say that I've been very zen about helping with her. No. There have been times in which I've gone off and yelled at her, and I've had to go back and make amends, and then she'll say, well, I'll think about it, and then she'll call me several days later and say, I've decided to accept your apology. I so want to say, go fuck yourself. But, you know, that's not going to really move us along on a positive level. So what I've learned is, I heard a friend of mine in the program in New York, she had been in, before she got sober, she used to go to Tompkins Square Park with her baby to pick up drugs each morning. And when I met her in the program, she said to me, Robert, you can put the big stick down. Pick up a smaller stick. And she had to say that, of course, several times, repetitively, for me to actually hear it. So I've tried to learn how to put the big stick down. I had never learned anything but, as I mentioned earlier, when I got tired of picking myself apart because I feel less than, left to my own devices, then I want to pick on you. And I want to make you small so I can feel big. That doesn't really engender good friendships, you know? You kind of know that when somebody else is doing that. So I told a therapist once, you know, I see all the world over there, and I'm over here. And I don't know how the fuck to get over there to everybody else. And she said, oh, you didn't ever learn how to nurture yourself. And I said, why would I do that? That's everybody else's job. I was never taught self-nurture. Who teaches self-nurture? So I've learned to self-nurture in this program. And I've learned to... And so I moved here and I sought out a sponsor who had a great spiritual program. On the way down here, I was thinking, you know, I could just disappear into Austin, not tell a soul, and nobody would know. And I'd go back to my old life. And I thought, or I need to get my ass to a meeting the very next night I get there and start this thing up. So I went there and made myself known. I just got here. I don't know anybody. And so I was looking for a sponsor at a really good spiritual program, and I found one. And so when we were working, she said, how are things with in your life? She said, how's the money stuff? And I said, not so great. She said, how's the job thing going? I said, not so great. She said, how's the relationships thing going? I said, not so great. It all sucks right now. And she said, time to make your God bigger, Robert. Make your God bigger. Invite God into every aspect of your life. You know, a lot of people have this problem with a higher power and the word God, and just make it whatever works for you. It's the beauty of this program is we're not taught a certain rigid definition. It can be whatever we want. And so I've got this very loose definition. It doesn't have to be anything else than that. And this loving energy. Every morning, I don't wake up happy, joyous, and free, first of all. Even after 13 plus years, I don't wake up there. I wake up with a low-grade, oh, shit. That's what I'm thinking. But I have to sit, and I have to put myself in a spiritually centered position. I have to pull that gratitude out of me, because I don't wake up grateful. I have to say, God, thank you for your unconditional love of me. Thank you for your unconditional acceptance of who I am right now. And thank you for your unconditional forgiveness of who I am right now. Now help me, please, to move my mind toward that all day long so that I can give that to other people in service to you. It makes a difference in my daily dealings with people. Because before I got sober, man, I met anger on the streets of New York all the time. I met anger in the subways. I was beating on taxicab hoods because they didn't stop fast enough. You know, they stopped too far into the crosswalk. And I don't meet anger anymore. And it's a beautiful gift. I say the set-aside prayer every morning. God, help me to set aside everything I think I know about my disease and about you, and about how to succeed in this job, and about my relationship to money, and how I deal with relationships, so that I can be of service to you. I want to always make sure I say that. I try to be of service to clients and to friends every day. I have a better relationship with my mom, as I spoke of, and I also have a better relationship with my sister. Certainly now that I don't live with her, and she's in Round Rock, and I'm in Austin, and that's great, because I grew up in this house of two women, and it was always you need to, you ought to, you should, and then I got into her, and that's why I fled thousands of miles away for years because I didn't want to hear that shit, and then I got down here and I heard in her house you need to, you ought to, you should, and I was like, oh no, she hasn't changed, you know. So, nonetheless, I came down to Austin with $2,000, not a lot of money, and through kindness of my sister and worked, I have now gotten to a different place, financially. I'm financially self-sufficient. I haven't had that in so many years. It feels really bizarre, and I'm really grateful that I can pay my bills on a regular basis. I'm not having to make those phone calls or dodge anybody's phone calls. I'm not in fear of an email threatening anything. I have sponsees. I have a sponsor. We needed a different way of working the steps. And so I've found this sponsor who has a different way of working the steps. And so it's an interesting experience to work the steps different ways with different sponsors. I go to meetings all the time, all the time. I'm almost 14 years sober. I go to meetings 5 nights a week because I can fall into the me trap at a moment's notice at any point in the day. You know, it says a conscious contact with God and in our program, and what I have to have is a constant contact with God. I'm not one of those monks that gets to sit in a monastery and pray all day because I got to go make money and run around and do all kind of shit. But I got to check in with my higher power all day long. Thank you, God, for that, or whatever just happened. Sometimes the what happened didn't feel good. And I say thank you anyway for whatever that was. I used to have an opinion about everything. I used to have to label everything you said or you didn't say negative or positive. And now I've learned, you know, there's another way. I can be Switzerland. I can be neutral. I don't have to have a fucking opinion about everything. It drives my mom crazy. She'll call and say, well, this is, you know, what do you think about that? And I'll say, I don't have a dog in that race, Mom. What? You have to have an opinion. No, I don't. Nope, I don't have an opinion. I can't tell you how freeing that is. I was a perfectionist. Some of you, in your active times, you might have felt like, you know, you needed to be perfect. And you can't be perfect. So, of course, it's just a self-fulfilling daily beat the shit out of yourself because you fall short, you fall short, you fall short. And now I've learned it's okay to be imperfect. Man, what a relief that is. My sponsor first said, you know, the high highs and the really low lows, they're going to kind of level out somewhat over the time in sobriety. And he was right. I was addicted to drama when I came in here. I needed something to chew on all the time. I needed some sort of personal conflict with somebody so that I could tell you about it and get you on my side. And because I needed to be right. Because right meant it meant I was okay. I don't have to be right anymore. Had a therapist one time said, you can be right or you can be happy. Which one do you want? And I said, why can't I have both? And she said, of course you would ask that. So I've learned I don't have to be right. And I don't have to have an opinion. And I work every day to try to let you be you. Because when I let you be you, I can look you in the eyes as an equal. And hopefully you feel like that guy's okay. I can relate to him. I can be friends with him. Because all I really ever wanted was the connection with other people. Only I didn't know how to ask for it. You were just supposed to give it to me. I wasn't supposed to have to do anything for it. But now I know I need to do the work to have the friendship with you. I need to do the work to have personal relationships that are positive with my family. I need to take responsibility for being a damned adult and get up and do stuff first. I can't have the expectation you're going to do your work first. I actually can't have the expectation some people are ever going to do the work. And I'm going to have to accept them for where they are. And so, you know, this moving down here to help my sister take care of our aging parent, a lot of people are in the same boat having to take care of aging parents. It's not fun. It's not going to get any better. It's going to get worse. But you know, years from now, I'll be able to say I was there. I was there at the end. I didn't hide my ass out of New York and my sister was burdened with it for all those years. So I'm doing my part. I'm showing up. And I'm showing up sober for it. And so I do the things that I need to do to be of service within reason. For my mom, I mean, she would love it if, like, she could live with me and I'd just wait on her hand and foot 24/7, and that's just not going to happen. I'm not a martyr. I'm just sober. So I have this higher power that I can't tell you. This is what sustains me, is my spiritual condition every day. When I get wound out onto the me limb, and it's about me, that's when I'm not spiritually fit, and I'm off the spiritual beam. When I start finding fault with you, you didn't call yet, you texted the wrong thing, you didn't answer. Where is the email response that I'm expecting from you? Because my expectations do not match reality. Nor were any of you or anybody else I know put on this earth to do what I say. I used to play hangman with you, and you didn't even know it. I would, you'd do something wrong, and I'd draw a little stick figure in my mind. Then you'd fuck up again, and I'd put that, draw a little noose around your neck. And then you'd fuck up again, and I'd hang you, and you're dead to me. And you didn't even know it. I move that cheese all the time. Move the goalpost. You didn't even know why you were cut out of my life. That's no way to try to have friendships. It's no way to have positive relationships in life. Is to not let somebody know what you want. I've learned to ask for what I want, and it's okay for you to say no. And it's not a judgment on me at all. Sometimes I'm really graceful at accepting that no, and sometimes I'm not. Then I have to go back and make amends. I want that spiritual centeredness every day because I don't want to make 10th step amends every day. I hate making amends. I don't want to step on your toes. I don't want to come at you with my expectations that you can't fulfill. So I go to AA every night so that I hear what I need to hear. I also go to AA. If I speak, great. If I don't, if I'm just a presence in the room, maybe I'm of help to somebody. Maybe somebody will ask something of me afterwards. It's a time for me to sit an hour with a like group of people to hear a lot of the same stuff, to hear how nuts I am, and to think it's okay, we're all working this stuff together. You know, I don't know how hard it is for you to ask for help, but when I came in the program, I wasn't going to ask for help. I was taught not to ask for help. I grew up with the teaching, don't ask anybody for help. You can do everything on your own. Don't cry. Men don't cry. Don't ask for help. And so I got in this program, and people said, well, you know, we ask for help. And I was like, oh, really? I'm supposed to ask you? Now I can be vulnerable, and I go to meetings because it's the only place, you know, it's the only place I can go and somebody say, Robert, how are you doing? And I can say, I've had a really hard day. Because most people say, when you say, how are you doing? They say, oh, I'm good. I'm great. You know, and their life is falling apart back at home. But in AA, we're truthful and we embrace being vulnerable. Some of the most amazing shares I've heard over the years are people being vulnerable and open, and they're asking for help. And you go up afterwards and you talk to the newcomer, and you say, I'm glad you're here. I hope you come back. We're glad you're here. Here's my number. Because now I know that when people give numbers, they're not given numbers to have sex. They're given numbers to be of help. When they say come to fellowship, it's not about the food. It's just about being out in public and trying to act somewhat with a like group of people and getting comfortable with myself. So as you embrace this program and you go out in the world and people say, come to fellowship, even if you don't want to, try it. Don't do what I did. Don't take my path, which was no, because my path was I love saying no, because it's this weird sense of control. I don't care if you say, I've got tickets to Hamilton. I want to say no. I don't care if you call and say, I've got dinner. No. My first response is no. For some weird reason. So now I have to pause and I have to think about it and I'll say, okay. And even if I don't want to go, I go. More often than not. And I have not ever felt the desire to drink. When I first got sober, in New York they call it mocus. Oh, you're just mocus. Because you're sober but you don't have any tools yet. So your mind's just bouncing everywhere and all these emotions are flooding in. And I had swallowed them for so many years, I didn't even know how to deal with them. I thought my feelings were facts until I got in this program and people said, no, feelings are feelings, Robert. Facts are facts. What? Because I thought if I felt it, therefore it is. That's how, you know, outsized in my ego I was. And so I've learned, okay, they're feeling, so what? You know, wait a minute, Robert, they'll pass. They'll pass. I've learned to be uncomfortable at times. It's okay. I don't have to blunt that feeling. And if it really persists, I've learned to pick up the phone and call another drunk and ask them how they are. Stop thinking about myself all the time. I'm my favorite subject to think about, of course, but it doesn't move the needle. What moves the needle is connection with another alcoholic. How are you doing? Enough about me. How are you doing today? Hey, do you want to go get a cup of coffee? Do you want to go to a meeting? Can you meet me at a meeting tonight? Oh, your car's in the shop. Can I come pick you up and take you to that meeting? That's how I try to live today. It works much better for me than the drinking part did, than all those drinking and using years. I can smile now. I can look you in the eye without embarrassment. I can speak truthfully because this program has given me tools to grow up. To grow up. I'm a 61-year-old man, and if I don't have tools now, it's going to be really ugly later on. I'm a big 12-stepper. Those are the tools that taught me how to grow up, how to right-size my ego, how to take responsibility. And so before I blame you for something, let me check on me. What was my part in it? What was my part in it? Before I come at you with what you've done. And those tools have served me well through the years. They've kept me from a relapse. I've heard so many times that, you know, the initial gift of getting sober is a gift. And the second time, it's brutally hard. And the repetitive times, it's brutally hard. I am grateful I have not experienced that yet. It's a yet. So I stave that off by going to meetings. A lot of people who get a lot of sobriety, they say they walk through the desert after a while. They leave the program, they commit suicide, any number of things. They stop calling their sponsors, stop going to meetings, stop working the program. And I'm left, and then what's left? My old stinking thinking comes back into play. The disease comes back in and says, it wouldn't be bad to just have one. You could have one. You could start with just one. And, you know, there's usually not any consequence. Well, I had one. I can have another. So I can't afford to have that thinking even start. Because I love being sober. You've heard it before. My worst day sober is 1,000 times better than my best day drinking. I continue to work this program. I'm so grateful that Chris asked me to come speak tonight. Thank you, Chris. I wish you all a wonderful night of sobriety. It's great to see these smiling faces. Thanks so much for listening to me. Appreciate it.